Welcome to the DeadWire podcast. I'm your host, Madalina Jakob, co-managing editor of DeadWire North America. I'm delighted to be joined today by two distinguished guests, Michael Chaisangattam, managing director at UBS Asset Management, and Greg Kass, principal at PGIM Credit. Michael has nearly two decades of experience in credit investing and restructuring. He joined Credit Suisse Asset Management, now part of UBS Asset Management, almost 20 years ago, and currently serves as head of restructuring for the Credit Investment Group, where he focuses on workouts, restructurings, and distressed credit. Prior to that, he was an associate at Wyld. Greg brings more than 20 years of experience in investing with troubled companies. He is a principal at PGIM Credit, where he focuses on special situations and opportunistic investments. Over the course of his career, he has held leadership roles at Wells Fargo, UBS, and Credit Suisse on the distressed and special situations trading platforms. Greg and Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you much.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
So let's start about, I wanted to ask you about the role of traditional lenders, because this role seems to be shifting quite meaningfully in today's market. I'd welcome your thoughts on this evolution, starting with the liability management side and what you're seeing today in the leveraged loan and the CLO market.
Who would you like to go first?
Kick off.
Sure.
I think it's often overused, but it's definitely the tale of two cities. You have a very hot loan market that continues to chug along, and then you have the triple C names or the difficult to refinance names. And many people have talked about the historically high triple C spreads, and that's due to a lack of CLO buyers, the liability management risk, and obviously a lot of software this year, which has become topical. So where are we with liability management? My view is liability management is a creative tool used to leverage document flexibility for companies to get what they need, which is usually liquidity, maturity, and discount. The discount part is often an emotional aspect of these deals for both sides, the companies and the lenders. And increasingly, there has been a shift from trying to get discount to more of a focus on maturity. The statistics do show that liability management tends not to work, that the majority of liability management transactions, the company winds up filing after 2 years, 3 years, and that's because there's over leverage, because the discount capture is small. A lot of times these companies emerge from these transactions with actually more debt than they went in. But that said, I don't think liability management is going away. It is a tool, it is a useful tool, but it is one of many tools. And I think when we approach capital structures and situations, it's one of the tools we need to consider in addressing over-levered capital structures.
So I think it's like a living, breathing animal in terms of what the LMEs have become, and they're going to constantly be fluid and influenced by what we experience and the sponsors that we're approached by and the crafty advisors that are trying to find different ways to either pick creditors off individually or, as Mike alluded to, find extensions, extend their runway, extend their optionality, and capture discount if possible. So what I think's changed recently, like the new normal, is that there's really no safe sponsor. I think we've learned that, and the gloves are off with everybody. And that's okay. That's their incentive, and that's what they're paid to do. And it would be surprised to see them treat us differently. I think as it relates to the creditor side, there's increased cooperation. I think we've used as much flexibility in the tools that we practice, the technology that we put in place. And I think we'll see what the next chapter looks like. We really haven't had a true credit cycle in a while. We have had our share of defaults, and there's, you know, our preference is still to use the tools to avoid protracted in-court process. That's just not anyone's best use of time and probably capital if we can get it done on a more simplistic out-of-court basis. But the other side of that is they don't always work. So you want to advantage yourselves, not to the detriment necessarily of other creditors, but you use the tools that are at your disposal. So LME is always going to be changing, and we're here to try to lead that effort.
So for you, if it doesn't work, it means that you have an LME O2, because from a sponsor's perspective, actually it worked if they can extend their optionality for 2 years. But when you say they are not successful, it's because you're saying they end up in Chapter 11. They're not really, we give them 2 years of time, but they still, we're still at the same.
No, it's a fair way of describing it. Failure from the sponsor's perspective. I think we look at our things that we're trying to accomplish in these negotiations, if you will, as the leading lenders that are in the process of determining our outcomes. And I think when we use the leverage that we have, we can improve our credit docs that sometimes have holes in them, if you will, we can tighten up, we can enhance our collateral, and we can enhance other factors within the documents, including coupons, we can get PIK interest, we can get make holes, we can get a lot of things that are creative. We can talk about that more in detail, but I think it can be a win for us in also terms of what our total return and our risk profile looks like in that capital structure. And then ultimately, if it's a business that doesn't work with that capital structure, we're in the right place to accomplish like what we call phase two, where we might take the keys of the company and set it up for success that way.
Can I just add something from the sponsor perspective? I don't know if it works if they get the runway and then the company files. Because I think their alternative is instead of doing an LME, in a lot of these situations, lenders are willing to engage in a more holistic restructuring. And that's not a restructuring where you're necessarily zeroing out the sponsor. You're giving them value for not doing the LME. You're giving them value for the option value they have in their equity for potentially restructuring earlier. And so if a sponsor does an LME and the company files 2 years later, they wind up with zero. You have to compare that to the alternative hypothetical of, okay, maybe they get a nice tip from the lenders for restructuring sooner and not doing an LME. And I think that's probably the discussion I wish happened more often.
Yeah. It's actually shocking and surprising that it just feels like it's a third rail for a lot of sponsors to take dilution before they have to.
Yes.
When in fact, I think it would be a recognition of that loss earlier, that dilution earlier, and having a chance to survive with the right cap stack would enhance returns for PE portfolios. However, when you're out there on the road marketing as a PE sponsor, it doesn't look good to say this investment didn't work. They've still got to mark that investment price, and that's the way it's been done for a while. So there's limitations on what I think their playbook might look like, even though it might be the best risk-adjusted return. But you mentioned that it's also interesting that we've seen, I think, more sponsors willing to put new money in to existing situations, not necessarily at the current point, but with some deleveraging. And so we've seen a multitude of variations there. And I think if creditors have an opportunity to put new money in, the sponsor has an opportunity to put new money in, that's probably the most aligned way to go forward. We are seeing.
So they wouldn't put new equity, it would be like more of that.
More junior capital. It could be like a pref, it could be a third out, it could be mezz piece or outright common, but at realistic valuations.
Not likely to find 100% of the debt.
And I think that increasingly the existing investors and lenders in that cap stack will have negotiated the same right. Okay, we like that attachment point too. We want to put up money side by side, or we want to do it in a way that works for our institutions and our vehicles. So we can talk about the flexibility we've created over time to manage that risk profile and actually capture more of that equity upside as the borrowers without necessarily taking full control.
Now let's talk a little bit about the dynamics in the cap structure, because there's often pricing dislocation driven by the fear of being prime or subordinated, right? So how does that go for you? Because you're both of you represent large informed participants and lenders. So how do you eliminate those monsters in the closet, let's say?
I love that term, and I appreciate you leading the witness here on this, in the sense that we definitely benefit from being large repeat players in this space. And as the world shifted in the last 5 to 10 years, a few things have happened. Players like UBS or PGIM have developed and built out much more significant resources and expertise to stay and play through if we choose to. We also have a lot more willingness to walk away from situations if that's not the case at any point in process. And I think those are important things to recognize. But on the LME front, when we talk about like a small lender versus a large lender, the small lenders have the disadvantage of not knowing what might be going on. They don't have the same relationships with the borrowers, bankers, or maybe other large creditors in the space. We, Mike and I, might have quietly started to organize, and we're in touch with a majority group. Maybe we've co-op, maybe not. Maybe we're just early innings. But we know that most of the dastardly things that a sponsor and their advisors might do, in this case, might require a 50.1% majority to amend the documents. They can't do that around us. And if we're the front-end maturity and we're secured, like there's a limited playbook at that point. So what that means is that we can open the closet and see there's no monsters, right? We control that dialogue, we control the script, and we can reduce that fear. So in a sense, what that, if you're a 1% or sub 1% lender, and we're in touch with, there's five players that own 50, it's a very big difference. And even though the landscape's changing, there's not as much creditor on creditor violence. I think there's still a lot of PTSD. I think a lot of the players have feared the LME, and maybe rightfully so. You don't want to wake up as a prime lender. And if that's avoidable, you do. And I don't want to add to that, but I think we certainly you have that edge as a large lender, and you can even double down or add to your positioning when things are trading lower, because that complexity, that fear factor that smaller lenders are worried about, if that doesn't exist, there's some alpha capture opportunities by understanding that additional discount isn't warranted, because that fear isn't warranted, because the actions that they're fearful of can't happen around us.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Greg. Position size and platform size are huge. If you have a big position size, you're going to be in the required lenders group, which is usually where the deal goes through. And just indirectly, platform size helps put you in the flow. The larger managers are more connected with the advisors, with the other holders, sponsors, companies, etc. I'm sure Greg has examples. We have examples where we were small and received favorable treatment because of our platform. And those things are helpful. That said, we are very cognizant of names where something might happen. It has the LME risk and we're not large. There are those situations where it makes sense to start thinking about heading for the exits. And this is not something that's just specific to LME. Size matters in bankruptcy, dips, exits. And the other thing is broad, large credit manager, we have to also value our time. And so having analysts cover $5 million positions is not a good return on their time.
Well said.
So Greg, you said credit violence isn't worth it. Why not? And Mike, if you have thoughts as well on this.
There's probably a very few large player left in the market that still have it on their mind. Maybe there's some of the kind of larger historical alts managers that would want to entertain this, whether they're looking at putting new money in for a drop down structure and carve out of collateral that might injure existing lenders.
There's the deal away, right?
The deal away, if you want to call it that. And so the deal away has been largely a failed threat from like probably 99 out of 100 deals, because it's almost always cheaper and more effective to deal with the incumbent lender group. And so that it's been a colossal time suck and waste for those smart alternatives managers that say, okay, I'm going to bid in the deal away. And they just get used as a shill in those situations. But we're like getting through a period that had historically, like last 5 years, quite a few deal away situations where some creditors were winners, some were losers. And that's not really on account of being just necessarily a large lender. You had to have a bit of a willingness to work against the creditor group and a bit of a deal with the devil sort of thing, and not to call sponsors bad names, but the idea has become much more, I think we've become more unified as creditor groups. And I think that it's a long-winded way of saying the juice is not worth the squeeze. We all value these long-term relationships. It's a long-term game, and we understand sponsors' incentives, but we also understand our own. And if you don't want to become extinct in this world, you have to look out for, I think, the collective creditor groups. So the caveat I'll make is that there are differentiated economics. We are large steerco lenders in many cases. You can restrict yourself, negotiate a deal, spend 6 months under the tent, get a good outcome for your creditor class. And if you get disproportionately large backstop fees or work fees, there are ways in which it's a fair outcome. And that's still very much appropriate, and that can obviously enhance returns. But I don't think we're trying to do that. It really the cost of the creditors. We're not trying to layer them or subordinate them or do things that would be like unnatural.
Yeah, look, I said earlier that LME is a creative and useful tool, but for the avoidance of doubt, I do think it is overused. And I think we all know that the structures after post-LME, they trade extremely poorly. So you, when you're engaged in these LMEs, you make guesses or assumptions on where the post paper that will trade, and it's always worse than you think. So then you're in this capital structure that has traded poorly. There's very few buyers, and it's hard to refinance that capital structure. You're just waiting for some alternative refinancing or for the company to be sold. And platform has, I think our number is somewhere between 10 and 15 LMEs. I don't think one has worked on our platform yet in terms of the final outcome.
And even if we want to enhance our position within that, sometimes you create what might look on paper like a positive outcome, but in the financial engineering on the backside is sometimes a layer cake that you take a bunch of material chunky loans and turn them into smaller tranches. You lose liquidity, you lose sometimes the ratings benefits that work for a lot of real money managers, CLOs in particular. So then you've created your own Frankenstein to what end? And I think we're cognizant of that as well. So we can use all the creativity we want and create complex instruments that might work in our favor, but sometimes the end game is not a great mark to market for at least a while. But we have some patience and we do understand things are mispriced and things can be a fatigue in situations. So we are willing to hold our ground and we'll continue to own things if we've got the underwrite that we believe in.
You're saying they haven't worked because you can't see a close to par recovery, let's say, or you can sell the company. So then the alternative is owning it or filing for chapter.
And in the meanwhile, you have a structure that just trades extremely poorly and there's no buyers.
Yeah. I guess we can have a different perspective. We're talking about from a sponsor's perspective in terms of the company's surviving, their ability to have the liquidity runway and the right cap stack. That's really what we're referring to. If you were going to say from a point in time, let's say Mike and I get engaged in a situation and the debt's trading at 55 cents in the dollar and then we got junior paper at lower levels and we build it. Cross group or we build whatever we do and we get an outcome that we create positive returns from that point in time all the time, right? It's not like it's a wasted effort on our side and we mitigate risks and we create optionality and we create better paper. So it's from a return perspective, not a waste of our time, but
you also don't have an option if the sponsor starts the LME. So we can sit back and say, I'm not going to do it.
The other options, as we can talk about in more detail, but it's holding our ground and saying, we're just going to sit here and take the keys. So that can be a clumsy, costly, arduous process, but it's sometimes the right outcome, even if it means you have to take more vol in your book, but it's the right outcome in many cases. And we'll see more of that ahead, I think, no doubt.
You also talked about a shift to a more cooperative restructuring framework, right? A few minutes ago. So I'm curious what's driving that change.
I'm absolutely seeing the trend of more pro-rata co-ops. I think anecdotally, we have 5 situations, we'll call them maturity conversations, that are on deck for us, that 4 are co-opt and the last one is in process of being co-opt. From what I see, the tipping point or the turning point was multicolor, that situation, which we're not in. But basically, from afar, it looks like a situation where the company went to the lenders and said, if you don't do this, we'll do the deal away. So it was the classic pitting 2 sets of lenders against each other to get people to agree to an extension. And I think the trend towards more just pro-rata co-ops is to try to get the company to address the capital structure better, try to get the sponsors to actually support the company and not just leverage their document flexibility or pit lenders against each other. So we are signing a lot of pro-rata co-ops. What those co-ops do is they basically, some might argue otherwise, but I think they basically take the ability to do an LME off the table with respect to the lenders vis-a-vis each other. One of the most heavily negotiated thing, there's some room for non pro rata. So one of the most heavily negotiated provisions in these sort of current co-ops is the Steerco carve out and whether it has to be reasonable and customary. I would say the majority do have some kind of reasonable customary market qualifier, something like that. But I would argue that especially if you have that qualifier, you can't do an LME with a wide co-op.
Yeah. And obviously, litigation that's ensued from various LME situations in the past. And I think just the continued understanding by the largest players that this is not how we need to operate. And I think it's led to that increased cooperation either through the agreements or otherwise. But
I don't know if you want to touch just a little bit on the recent anti-co-op litigation. Clearly it hasn't affected the trends of co-ops. You just mentioned there's more pro rata. And
I don't think it has affected its willingness to sign co-ops. I'm not an antitrust lawyer, so can't speak to the merits, but it has not affected people's willingness to sign co-ops.
this was, you know, I think it was a really helpful context on how restructuring dynamics are evolving. So if we're staying on the theme of how capital structures themselves are changing, I would also like to talk a little bit about how there's some creativity on the financing side, because we're seeing more hybrid structures that look like debt but behave like equity. So what's driving that trend?
I can talk a bit about it, Will. I think I have to always try to rein in interest and creativity, because you don't want to create instruments that aren't on market. But at the same time, when we're looking at a collection of assets as lenders, sometimes we want to benefit from the underappreciated value that might be trapped in a business. It could be spectrum value, and there's multiple examples of that. It could be a misunderstanding of the, in the case where it's maybe not a restructuring where we don't take the keys, but there is a lot of optionality that we're creating for a sponsor. And whether that's done captured through an asset sale IPO type CVR, this contingent value right can be either separated or embedded in an instrument. And then clearly, like the traditional ways of capturing equity optionality through preferreds, converts, warrants, or just common, having those either stapled, attached to, or as part of a consideration package are increasingly valuable, because it's not just schmuck insurance, but as we collectively have decided to stay in a risk position and we're applying it through a process, we want to capture that upside that we're helping deliver, particularly if we're putting the right cap structure in place. We don't want to hand the upside back to the sponsor or public equity holders if that's the case. So it's a self-interested way of approaching things, but it's also, I think, with we've been able to, through the technology that we've worked on for years, build workarounds for things that might have looked like impossible ways to invest from either like a CLO or a real money perspective where you might have account limitations. We're not trying to bend rules, but we're trying to put our clients in the opportunity to succeed and have the best returns with the limitations of the structures themselves and the vehicles themselves.
Yeah, it's put simply just a way to maximize recovery. You're working with a lot of lenders, and by and large, most lenders need to invest the capital in a debt-like format to meet the criteria of their funds. And a lot of these companies now that Greg and I work through can't sustain meaningful real debt. So it's creative structuring.
Can you give us some real examples? Maybe like Cineworld, Anthology, if you want.
Yeah. So in both cases, their lenders funded a dip. In both cases, they really couldn't sustain real significant amounts of real debt. The bankruptcy plan in Cineworld provided for a common equity rights offering, and it had a lot of upside to it. Most of these rights offerings are done at very good valuations on trough EBITDA with a market 35% discount to plan equity value. The Anthology plan had a preferred equity rights offering with, I think, a MOIC, something like that. And so both plans had a feature where anyone could use this, but this was most useful for par lenders. Both plans had a feature where instead of getting repaid on your dip, you could elect to use your dip as dollars to participate, in the case of Cineworld, the common equity rights offering, in the case of Anthology, the preferred equity rights offering. So that was a structure there that the par lenders used to be able to do the things and achieve the objectives Greg described.
Yeah, they lowered the company. And then I think in Converge One, we had a different type of situation. It was more about backstop fees.
Yeah, so we weren't involved. My understanding of Converge One was it was a $245 million equity rights offering done at the classic 35% discount I mentioned, with a backstop fee of 10%. I think in the pleadings, I think the majority group or the plan proponents, whatever you call them in that deal, did not offer the backstop to the minority group. And I think in the pleadings, the minority lenders said that they weren't given a chance to provide any financing, and that backstopping was worth 31% higher recovery. So the court didn't say you can't get backstop fees. I think the court there said that backstop fees need to be market tested, which I agree with the spirit of this decision. It can't be, dips can't work where 50% of the lenders say I have the votes that you need to prime for a dip so I can do whatever I want. Same thing in a plan. I don't think bankruptcy works if 2/3 of lenders say I have the votes that you need to confirm a plan, so you have to accept whatever economics I offer. So I think the spirit of the decision is right. what it means to market test a backstopping opportunity is difficult because there is no market for it. It's a captive financing, similar to a DIP financing. So I think that's something people will work through. Maybe it will be similar to DIP financings now, how on day one, the company's bankers get up on the stand and say they worked really hard and talk about the comps and they push the lenders as much as they could. And it will help, I think, moderate a little bit the grabbiness in some of these situations. But it's definitely one of these bankruptcy cases now that's going to get thrown out by every committee, every minority group to challenge a plan. Yeah.
So in LMEs, we have a bit of a code of ethics that prevents, to some degree, predatory behavior against smaller lenders. But the bankruptcy courts haven't quite gotten there. And right now, there's mechanisms that really, if not tested the way we've seen done in Converge One and others, you can have perverse outcomes where there's a massive differential between a SteerCo economic and a minority lender economic. And again, we haven't had a huge wave of bankruptcies lately where you probably have more aggressive behavior, but I think it's not the spirit of really what was intended. And I think companies are weaponizing the DIP, the RSA, and that process to get a sub rosa outcome where you basically have a pre-wired confirmed plan without the opportunity to object to it. So lots too much in the weeds in a sense, but like for our audience, I think there's an evolution in real time, but it's also going to depend on what circuit you're filing in and how debtor friendly the judges are. More to come on that front.
Now, if we go back to the creative structures, I think, Mike, you mentioned a structure where a CLO effectively created a convert that turns into equity. So how does that work?
Yeah, that was a situation. This was a public bankruptcy last year, a company that really could not sustain any true debt other than its ABL and sale leasebacks. It already had this debt that kind of rode through the bankruptcy. And so with there and CLOs, there were a lot of CLO participants. CLOs have gotten more flexible over the past 10, 20 years, but they still generally need to invest in a debt-like instrument. So there was a $180 million exit facility. The rate was all PIK. And it had a conversion feature that could only be exercised after 1 year. It wasn't convertible by any individual holder. The majority holders had to convert it, and it converted into, I forget the exact percentage of the equity, but it converted into a substantial amount of the equity. So I think people viewed it as an equity. I think people invested in it assuming it would equitize and viewed it as an equity-like instrument, but it did meet the legal definition to not be a convert, because CLOs generally can't buy converts in most CLO indentures.
And you talk about the facility getting weaponized. I don't know if you want to tell us how that works, or if you've seen some, you have some examples.
A couple of simple ways. One is companies have been tying the ability to participate in the DIP to an RSA. So you're basically consenting to vote for a plan. And if you decide you don't like the plan because you might not be getting the same economics as a different lender in your class, you run the risk of losing an objection and missing a roll-up element. So the roll-up isn't a key feature of that coercive tie. Other examples are when a DIP may have the option to equitize in whole or in part, and that can have very dilutive economics. So if you don't play the DIP or you don't fight the DIP, a lot of the future of the case has been baked. And I think those are ways, among others, that we've seen an acceleration. And for a plan that is otherwise not like a pre-back, but operates in effect like one because of those features.
No, I was just going to say, 20 years ago, there were actually real free fall bankruptcies. And the company would go in and figure it out. And the DIP had just a maturity. Oh, this DIP matures in a year or a year and a half.
But it was not the fulcrum.
It wasn't tied to a plan. Nowadays, every bankruptcy is prearranged, pre-negotiated, and everything is so intertwined that the secured creditors' lawyers are doing a good job of basically doing their best to make it that when the judge approves the DIP, the judge is approving the plan.
Exactly. It's so expensive, so you want to go in and out as quickly as possible, in a way. So you become owners, basically, by being DIP lenders.
I don't want to overstate that the DIP becomes a fulcrum a lot, but I think it's a tool to...
That's definitely
not
the goal.
Yeah,
it's not exactly.
Yeah. It's
in,
not
in
the goal,
past,
it's also
just
not
to,
really pass it. It can be
to get a fee, right?
Yeah,
like it was a 13% DIP,
right.
for 1 year you were getting that fee as a deep lender, and then
it's more of a disguised backstop fee of sorts, or just it's another way of disguising economics that can be disproportionately. We're usually on the winning side of this. We're not trying to be like poo-poo the whole market in the process, but you have to have an underpinning of general fairness. Things don't work over time. We're not trying to drive people out of business and hurt their returns. And we get the phone calls the next day like, hey, I was a first lien lender and now I'm a fourth lien lender. You don't want to go through that experience, right? And it's also that in the process, we want it to be transparent, fair. And if you have the risk appetite and the capital and the flexibility within your mandates to do X, Y, or Z, then we want you to do it and not limit people in ways that really are predatory or hurt their economic returns. Now, some may say, I don't want to do that. That's up to them. But I think, yeah, the dip is an important part of the total package of different tools.
This is just my personal view, but if you want to make all of this stuff more straightforward, you could also go back to a regime where dips were just like dips that were repaid in cash fees or PIK fees. But I think the whole roll-ups and holdbacks and backstop fees and equity and attaching equity has made, I don't know how judges actually sometimes understand how expensive some of these dips are. The dips have become very convoluted to understand exactly, okay, what is happening to my recovery here.
And since you talked about how you're sometimes using the dip to become owners, how is this? Is this something that you're willing to do? You're comfortable just being there and owning companies? Because this is shifting the lender behavior incentives, right? And I'm just curious, what are the broader implications for the credit markets when US CLOs? It seems to me out of this conversation that you've at the beginning, you hinted that you would like more out-of-court restructurings where, you know, the sponsor would give away some equity and you would become an owner of the company.
We're always prepared to own companies if we think that's the value maximizing outcome. I think that is a determination you have to make on a case-by-case basis. This is not, right now we're dealing with a lot of secular credits that it's not clear their trajectory. This is not like 2009 where it was just like a cyclical trough and everything was good company, bad balance sheet, or I shouldn't say everything, but most things were good company, bad balance sheet. So you have to make that individual determination, but we're not looking to lose money on dips or equitize dips. That's never intentional. That's never our objective. I don't think any lender wants to equitize a dip from the outset, but that does have to happen from time to time. But we also look at it from we're trying to get the best outcome. And the problem with attaching a lot of, and I think I'm guessing Greg faces this issue and other managers face this issue, the problem with attaching so much economics to new money for a lot of is that you have a loan in 80 funds. Invariably, not all 80 funds can participate in the new financing, even if it's structured in a way where, in the most favorable way to a debt investor, and let's say 70 funds can participate, we want a good outcome for all 80 of our funds.
We manage for a number of different account types, very complex different pockets of opportunistic capital, CLO, loan capital, high yield, multi-strat, so really. We have the same issues where if you have an account that isn't prepared for one reason or another, we don't go into details, but it's going to have a difficult time writing new money in, even if it's a new debt, right? Then it's going to be hard in this day and age to get the right outcome for that account type. And so we try to push back on everything needs to have new money attached to it, right? There are times when that was clear and that we're in the pandemic and everything at companies EBITDA is zero or negative, and you have a capital structure that can't support any debt, and then you need to recapitalize it. The best you could do at that point was like CLOs writing a new PIK debt in and then having stable equity attached, because effectively that was like quasi workaround. And dips are a tool and a technology. Other stable equity is a technology, convertible instruments are technology. So we play with what we have, and again, some vehicles are more built for equity duration, and some are built for smaller amounts of that, right? And I can all agree there's been some tremendous outcomes, but not all, right? If you are going into something, if you have a vehicle like a CLO that's a levered vehicle, you have to have cash interest bearing assets and not to offset these liabilities. It doesn't work. You couldn't have a whole equity stack, even if it was 3-4 MOEX, like you would bust the vehicle before you got to the other side. Some other vehicles are more flexible. So it's about balancing, position sizing, appetite for risk, and finding the right sweet spot. But I think on the other side of that is, and there's always been lenders preparing to be owners. So there was a loan to own. Distress for control strategy was a big push 20 years ago. Now it's not really called the same thing, and it's a special sits now. And all
capital
the
solutions.
But we're still part of that business. And I think if there was any like misunderstanding, like larger lenders, PGIM and UBS have in-house sophistication and expertise. We've gone through so many of these wars and we've learned how to prepare. So we're the quality sponsors on the other side. This is not a situation where you have like 10 years ago, 300 hedge funds would all own 50 bips of the business. You might have 5-6 holders or sometimes 3 or 4 that own a majority of it, right? Right. And so that's much more of a cooperative effort. It's much, we build the governance, we build the board. It's just like anything else. We prepare and we execute, right? We accelerate that preparation when it looks more obvious that, hey, our underwrite, we hope it's right because we're going to own this business. So let's figure out how to make the most of it. Is this a liquidation? Do we sell off the pieces? Do we sell off segments? We're the new owners, right? So you do everything that a sponsor would do in preparation for that. And it's a lot of work. And in the right cases, we get great results. But it is a longer duration trade in some cases. And it's a different approach than I think people would expect because this group of lenders is coming back in. It's usually a few institutions that are going to re-underwrite the business, figure out who to hire. You got to get the expertise for the board. You got to make sure that there's alignment. You got to make sure this is the right management team. You got to make sure that we agree if this is a pivot or we have the right cap stack. Are we capitalized the right way? It's the same questions that you would otherwise assume are part of the conversation. But when you practically put it into practice, it's a lot of effort and you can screw it up if you don't put a lot of time and effort into that. But we're increasingly, large asset managers are having success playing through situations when we do take the keys.
Are there some mistakes that trying to avoid? No, you don't want to go there necessarily.
No, there's obviously situations that don't.
No, I'm saying that you would like some mistakes that you would like a new lender to avoid if they do that.
Yeah. Systematically.
Right. Yeah. Well,
or let me frame it differently. If there's some advice that some, you know, a new lender to this game can learn from you, since you guys have decades of experience.
Yeah, that's a fair question. I think I've been through a number of these. I think preparing earlier, like it doesn't have to be at the moment of the change of control. Here are the keys. Go figure out your board. Go figure out your business plan. You want to be engaged, and the largest lenders typically are engaged with management and the board before that change of control takes place. You may have an odd situation where there's some protective layer, be it founder or otherwise, it doesn't want you to speak to management. But in general, you build rapport, you build understanding of where they went wrong, right? Sometimes you have an over-levered sponsor-owned business that was throwing everything against the wall they could to grow into their cap structure. And if it wasn't for that irrational approach that was driven by the sponsor, because they were never going to win if by cost-cutting, by example, and running it more efficiently, this management team actually could be the right management team. So figuring out who they are, what their goals and objectives were, what do they see and understand in the business, pull that information out. And you still might find out they're the wrong team. And you get a very sophisticated board in place that has the industry expertise that can really mentor and help the C-suite along. And then you figure out if it's the right management team or a new management team that's going to come in, really align everybody. And you got to align the personalities. There's a lot of characters on boards and big personalities. So I think all that is the behind the scenes effort. If you can get as much of that built out before you exit, then you have a strategic direction that can change, but it's like anything else. That's the work that would be done by a sponsor, and it's the work done by the controlling shareholders that are the former lenders in these situations. So I think preparation and then organization and execution, and like everything else in life, the devil's in the details here. But to do it, if you fail on any of those fronts and you just kind of sloppily walk out of there and people are pointing fingers, the ball gets dropped. And that's not something that we want to see happen or we really allow to happen when we have material interest in it.
I think my first answer is similar to what Greg is saying. I think often we don't change things quickly enough in the company. And that's in the nature of, I think, lenders who take over companies or operate by committee. It's not unified sponsorship. And I guess my second answer, and I think the industry has gotten better on this, but I think my second answer would be that we over-lever companies.
As they exit, you mean?
I mean that, again, going back 10, 15 years, everyone was always like, okay, what is trough EBITDA? Can I put 4x on it? I think we're better about that now. I don't know if you agree, Greg. I think we're better about saying, okay, yeah, let's just lever this as low as possible because Chapter 11 is so expensive.
There were so many valuation fights in the past. There are not that many now.
Yeah, bankruptcy's really become a take us out or you're done.
Yeah,
there's no valuation. And you're right. Those valuation fights are what push
it's
consideration.
Like the second lien and unsecured. Or,
yeah. Now it's if you can't take out the first lien, forget about everything below the structure.
I think there's also the internal incentives for some vehicles. It's like we manage a lot of CLOs, like you want to get as much par collateral back. A mix of debt to equity favors pushing more debt, even if it's off market coupons. And we push back on that just because it's not the right answer for your debt trading well. It's not the right answer for the company's sustainability. It's not the right answer for ratings or optics. It just so you just have to look at it as a small piece of a larger portfolio and do the right thing for the company. Do the right thing for the longevity and your ability to succeed, especially with your equity hat on. And so some lenders will be like, oh, I'm the equity in the debt. I'm just going to throw away the equity. That's definitely not the right plan. And it's missing a lot of opportunity when those situations.
I think lenders definitely value the debt currency more than the equity currency. And I know maybe it's not hard to blame them. Like right now, we're in a world where restructured equities do not trade well.
That's what I want to say. And we have a track record in the past years that you can't really sell the companies didn't do that great.
Yeah. I would think there was, this is now dated, I think there was a study like 20 years ago that said most plan values are too low and you could just go blindly buy every restructured equity at emergence and it would trade up, which is definitely not the case anymore.
Yeah,
the world's changing as we sit here today with the amount of AI disintermediation and like it's hard to predict, I think, the disruptive nature of a lot of changes. And look, I think that we will have different cycles and different vintages of restructurings. There's been some phenomenal outcomes and we've been part of some of those. I can't talk about it, unfortunately. But there's a lot of situations where you pick and choose.
You can't tell us the example, the phenomenal
yeah.
one?
Yeah.
No, but it's good.
Yeah, and so they're knowing that the work is rewarded, it's an important alpha driver, an important part of the asset management game, and to not say I'm just going to abandon this at the point which I get my equity, or there's the tools to actually drive that and create the value. It's an important part of this world that we have the resources and expertise to deliver on, and we're not going to shun that. Like it's same fiduciary responsibility. You got to be there managing the equity side just as you do on the debt, and I think we'll continue to do that. And I think we'll have a more robust. I'm not wishing for this because it means we'll be working nights and weekends again. But a more robust credit default cycle at some point. And what really drives that is a TBD. Is it software companies that are going to get disintermediated? Is it the fact that like chems and a lot of other industries are oversupplied globally? There's a lot of different drivers of things that we're currently seeing, and it's reflected in a lot of security prices.
And software has the maturity wall, right? Everybody talks about them, but I don't know.
Huge
29, 28, yeah.
I think there's like a ton in 28 and then a lot, but not as much as in 29. We haven't gotten started yet, really, in earnest on ours. But I don't think, and I hope I'm right, I don't think that most of those are change of control situations. I think people view those as trying to figure out a way to address the maturity.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But yeah.
Because you are major lenders to some of the software companies, right? So you will.
We have software exposure.
Yes, yeah.
I think everybody does.
Yes,
people.
I mean, it's a huge market.
Software.
Yeah.
I think on the as traditional
what I was trying to say
segment,
is that
yeah.
if in 2 years or even next year, it's going to be on your table. What, am I going to do an LME? Am I going to do a change of control? So you are the decision makers for some of these
some
credits.
Of it we will be, yeah. I'm very grateful that our, particularly middle market Loanland, our team was ahead of this and got our software exposure way down. So we're massively underweight on that. So we'll hopefully less situations, but we still have situations. There's no question. You always do. And some of them trade today at levels that don't necessarily make sense if you think these businesses don't go away. They're trading at levels that are like reflective of, remember the white pages back in the day, like you're creating businesses at one or two turns
yeah.
of EBITDA. And you're like, wait a minute, there's cash in the balance sheet. So somebody's wrong, right? We don't know who yet. Maybe they do go away and that quickly. But there's opportunity already in terms of where things trade. I think the restructuring race is probably yet to kick off.
And it's interesting that you said not that many change of controls. That's the doom and gloom that some people expected, right? With software, because some of them...
Optimism. I think it's really case by case. If sponsors are willing to support it and the trajectory of the business is fine, we're into a conversation. I do think, given the very divergent potential outcomes on software names, because some businesses are going to do fine, some businesses are going to go away. When I say change of control, I meant lenders taking a change of control. I think there are businesses that lenders may need to push to be sold, for example. So I think the software sample set, I'm not sure is necessarily going to lead to a lot of Chapter 11s, but I definitely don't think they're cookie cutter, that there's going to be a lot of innovation and a different solution for every company depending on the trajectory of the business, the underwrite, and what the sponsor is willing to do.
In the other sectors that you mentioned before that you said building products and some...
Greg and I have one building products name together that's not going to say the name, but is very much in the market. That's, at least for me, my only building products exposure. But I think building products is a focus right now because of the cyclicality and the headwinds. Coming into the year, Chems was... Obviously, last year, Chems was very topical. The Iran war has alleviated, I think, a lot of the pressure on some of the big Chems names.
Yeah. See how long that lasts. But you're absolutely right. Yeah. And I think that there's not going to be a single playbook for any sector. But I think from a lender's perspective, if there are maturity issues that are looming and lenders have those conversations ahead, I think the framework that we bring to it is that we don't know what 3 to 5 years looks like for some of these businesses. So if we are going to extend in any fashion, to give optionality and runway, I think you trade that for cash sweeps and amortization, ways to pull your risk out of the business and say, you can play with some of the upside and maybe we'll share in that. Maybe there's a perfect balance there. But I think it's going to be difficult to say, okay, we're just going to give you a freebie, kick the can, and you can take the ups and we'll take the downs. That's just not the right message.
I 100% agree. We need to be de-risked. So if there's a business that can be sold, if you can increase the amort, if there's a creative private debt solution that comes in and helps de-risk the lenders, I think that's what I refer to as the creative structuring that's going to need to happen to address these structures.
Any final thoughts before we wrap up? What will define the next phase of this evolution of CLR? I guess ownership, cooperation, more structuring, innovation?
I think for me, cooperation, structuring, innovation.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the right path. We'll see as it goes, but I think we've got a long history in the market and we hope to have a long history going forward. And I think that cooperation is the key to that. And then understanding really how we can enhance value for our clients along the way. So it's going to be a fun journey ahead.
On this note, I think we'll wrap up our conversation. Thank you so much for your insights, your perspectives today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Madeline.
And thanks to everyone for listening. As always, you can subscribe to or download every episode on Apple or Spotify and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our team at thatwire.com.